From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Journalism at home and abroad on this edition of Fresh Air. British journalist, poet, and critic James Fenton writes unconventional reports of revolutionary upheavals. Today he tells us about witnessing the fall of Saigon and the downfall of the Marcos government in the Philippines. His reports are collected in the new book All the Wrong Places. Here at home, Marlene Sanders was one of the first women to report on network television. She was the very first woman to anchor a network TV evening newscast. We talk about the obstacles women have been up against in TV news. Also, Ken Tucker reviews Stay Awake. It's a new collection of popular tunes from Disney films, performed by jazz and rock musicians. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews director Ken Russell's new movie, The Lair of the White Worm. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. James Fenton has been lucky or unlucky enough to have witnessed cataclysmic events of recent history. When Saigon fell and Americans evacuated, British journalist James Fenton stayed on to find out what revolutionary justice would be like under the North Vietnamese. When the Marcoses fled the Philippines, Fenton was among the first people to enter the abandoned palace, and he has one of Imelda's monogrammed towels as a souvenir. Riots and elections recently brought Fenton to Korea. Fenton has filed for The New Statesman, The Guardian, and The Washington Post, but his specialty is lengthy first-person pieces, several of which have been published in Granta magazine. These capture both the spectacle and the day-to-day trivial details of history in the making, and describe what it's like to be in a foreign country covering somebody else's revolution. For 3 years, Fenton moved indoors to cover stage spectacles, working as the theater critic for the London Sunday Times. His reports from Vietnam, Cambodia, the Philippines, and Korea are collected in the new book All the Wrong Places. He's now based in the Philippines, covering the Pacific for the British paper The Independent. James Fenton was a poet when he first went to Vietnam, and he had no real credentials as a journalist.
I didn't really know what I was going to do at all when I got there. And really, I just learned as I went along, learned from other people. Foreign correspondents are supposed to be tremendously competitive, and indeed they have to be at times. But actually, when you're working in a pretty remote country, most journalists are very cooperative with each other, and you learn a lot from watching other people work.
You've written that you think the rules of objective journalism were written by old men wanting to stamp out good writing. So why did you want to go abroad and report?
Well, at the time that I went abroad, I was working for... I'd been working for an English magazine, The New Statesman. And the kind of rules that I'm talking about there, like the rule that says you mustn't use the first person in a piece of reportage, that kind of rule does not apply to English magazine journalism, and it applies much less to English newspaper journalism, indeed. It was only out there that I began to see how American newspapers work and how very, very restricted you are in terms of style when you're writing for them.
You didn't really know what you were looking for when you first went to Vietnam and Cambodia.
Not really, no. I wanted to see the place. I wanted to see what was going to happen. It was just after the American forces had been withdrawn, so it was after the Paris Peace Agreement. And one sort of knew that those regimes couldn't last forever, but we didn't really know how they would crumble or what the time scale was.
You were in Vietnam for the fall of Saigon. The American journalists were forced to evacuate. You were allowed to stay because you were credentialed by a British paper. Did you want to stay with the panic all around you? Did you want to be there?
There were a lot of other nationalities there. And it was really only in the journalistic community, it was really the Americans who were worried. And the reason why they were worried was a lot of them thought, what will happen specifically to Americans when the city falls? Now, there was a general worry about in what way will the city fall? Will it be shelled first? Will there be fighting street by street and so on? And I think we were all worried about that and thinking what would we do if we were stuck without provisions for a long time and so on and so forth. Or if there was a general turn against foreigners, if all foreigners were assumed to be Americans. But what we didn't have was this feeling that that we were Americans. And I think that unnerved quite a lot of people. There were, by the way, some Americans who stayed on, including journalists and cameramen and so on, but only a few.
As people were evacuating and you stayed on, you were almost watching people plan out how they planned to die. You saw a group of lieutenants who decided they'd just sit here and drink until they were killed. And people were all around you deciding how they'd either get evacuated or die.
Well, it's true there was a considerable panic. Some of this, I mean, there was an element of it which was also play acting, like these guys who said they would sit there and drink until they were killed. I didn't take that kind of stuff particularly seriously. What was perhaps most striking was towards the end when the looting broke out and when there was this period in which there was no... as it were, no government there, no law and order. And suddenly, at that point, people start looting. And looting is a very strange thing to me because people do it at the most dangerous time, when you'd think that they would be much better, you know, better advised to sit cowering at home and wait for the danger to pass. No, they go out and find a shop and break it open and then do everything to get, you know, whatever they've found home. It's a panic reaction that is not necessarily connected with, you know, with your actual poverty, that, you know, you've found something valuable and this is your big break in life. Because often the things that people found were things they would never be able to use. You know, like an air conditioner if they only had a wooden hut or something like that.
For a reporter, you said you were faced with an odd situation of either going to see what was actually happening around you or writing about it. What was the problem? You thought that the lines would go down and you wouldn't be able to give your story to your paper unless you wrote it right then and there.
You always have that problem. But if you're what we call a stringer, if you're a freelance journalist working for several different clients, then you have a choice, basically, between writing the story a lot of times, and when it's a big story, this is when you're going to make your money. So you're writing it for several different clients, or actually going out and getting the story. That's why I say, you know, there are two golden rules for stringers. One is the more you file, the more you earn. And the second is the more you file, the less you learn. Everybody in journalism wants to work for one good organization so that they can really have time to research a story properly and then write it in their own way. But it takes you a long time in life to reach that position.
There was another irony that you faced as a writer freelancing for American papers and being one of the few people left doing that. The Washington Post wanted you to do some writing for them after the fall of Saigon. But you said it was bad news to have an exclusive situation like that because without a reporter there from the New York Times, it wasn't an official story, so it didn't matter that much whether the Post hired you or not. So you couldn't get a favorable price out of them.
That's right. It's true. It's true. Never get into an exclusive situation. Get an exclusive story against the competition, but never get into a place where you are the only reporter there, because that is not a commercially valuable thing.
Did you feel that the story needed to be validated by other American journalists before it was a real story?
The point was the Washington Post had asked me to stay on, and once all the other journalists had left, I then sent a cable saying, yes, but, you know, I need proper payment now, and stated my terms, and was sacked immediately. And this was rather unfortunate, because there wasn't another plane out, and I just missed getting out. Another funny thing happened in those days. There was one guy who left, you remember when all the helicopters evacuated? This was a British journalist who left on those helicopters and got back to England and wrote a book about the fall of Saigon. I left Saigon 3 months later. His book had already been published and was already out of print by the time I got back. I was writing a book myself, and I was quite astonished at the speed with which that had happened.
When you stayed on in South Vietnam, you really weren't sure whether you'd get arrested or not. Would you describe that real moment of indecision where you really weren't sure what your fate was going to be?
I just saw this tank going towards the gates of the palace, and I thought, great, I will take a ride on it. This is what you should do. This is the great moment. We're going to storm the palace. And first of all, they thought I was being very hostile and sort of made as if to, I mean, this is the soldiers, made as if to hit me with a rifle. And then I held out my hand and so on and so forth. Finally, I pointed to the tank and said, can I go on it? And they said, yeah. And then we rammed the palace gates and so on and went into the compound. And at that point, I realized that there were other soldiers on the tank, were prisoners, were South Vietnamese army prisoners, who were extremely unhappy about being on this tank altogether. And then I wondered, maybe I've been taken prisoner. I don't know. And I thought, well, you know, I'll find out when I get off the tank. So I sort of jumped off the tank, and turned out I wasn't. So that was okay.
Well, you were there to write stories that very few other journalists could actually get. Was there much censorship of your stories? Were you able to report what you wanted to after the North Vietnamese took over?
Oh, no. Gradually, what happened was there was a marvelous period in which nobody knew what the regulations were. And then you could travel around the countryside and talk to whomever you wanted, and anybody who was going to speak to you, you know, and was able to. Then gradually people were told not to talk to foreigners, and also you were confined to Saigon itself. And at this point, any sources that you might have had before were drying up. Either the people had left, or they no longer were in possession of any information. So it was becoming very, very difficult to work anyway. And the money had dried up and so on and so forth. And gradually, just in a natural kind of way, it was getting more or less impossible to go on. And then they also started censorship and, you know, suggesting improvements to stories. I remember the one that particularly irritated me and made me realize I wasn't going to be able to go on working there was a very small detail, but it was a factory, story about a factory that was being forced to stay open. It was a factory that made net, and they had no nylon string to make the nets with. And it was being forced to stay open nevertheless. I wrote this story, and in the censorship office, they said, couldn't you say it's being obliged to stay open despite the difficulties, i.e. cutting out all this stuff about there being no raw materials? And you realise that this is the form that their own journalism takes, that you never tell a simple detail. You don't say, you know, the simple fact of the matter. You dress it up in a kind of ideological guise. A friend of mine, a very distinguished cameraman who was there at the time, called Neil Davis, who was the cameraman who much more recently filmed his own death in Thailand. He was there And he happened to be doing some reporting for Reuters. And he reported a coach accident. A coach had gone off the road and everyone in it had been killed. Now, pure traffic accident story. And this story was censored. And in a society, in that particular society in Vietnam at that time, anyway, at the best of times, there were massive rumours going around. The whole place was a rumour mill. But if you have a press that doesn't report traffic accidents, then everybody, when somebody just sort of disappears, will assume that, you know, he's been carted away for political reasons or whatever. You fuel the rumours, and you could see the Vietnamese doing this themselves, that they actually, the North Vietnamese won a lot of respect for the way that they took over Saigon initially, and then gradually they threw away all the respect that they'd won by stupid things like, I mean, they later did it with worse things, but just by stupid little things like not countenancing a press that said there's been a traffic accident.
Was it because of that that you knew it was time for you to leave?
Well, I knew it was time to leave when they started censoring my copy, and still the banks hadn't opened and so on, and I just couldn't go on.
Was it hard to get out?
No, it wasn't. You got out by the United Nations, the UNHCR, the High Commission for Refugees.
Well, you were in the Philippines at the time that Corazon Aquino was elected. I want to talk to you about your experiences in the Philippines, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is journalist James Fenton, and his pieces are collected in a new book, All the Wrong Places, Adrift in the Politics of the Pacific Rim. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest, James Fenton, is a poet, journalist, and former theater critic who's written for many British periodicals and was also the chief book critic and theater critic for the London Sunday Times. His new book, All the Wrong Places, includes his reporting from Vietnam, Cambodia, the Philippines, and Korea. He's joining us from Station WAMU in Washington, D.C. Let's talk about some of your experiences in the Philippines. First of all, why did you go to the Philippines?
I went... I just got curious about what I'd read about the Philippines, and... strange stories. I mean, there are all kinds of strange things happen in the Philippines recently. Recently, or last year, last Good Friday, I saw two women being crucified on Good Friday. I didn't intend to go to the crucifixion of women. I just sort of happened to come across it. I was looking for a crucifixion, of which there are lots and lots. You know, people crucify themselves, and they do all kinds of strange things, very interesting things in the Philippines. It's a very lively, spiritual culture. A lot of religion there. It's rather like what I imagine Europe was like in the Middle Ages in that way. Tremendous processions and so on. Now, I went out to the Philippines wanting to look at just normal, everyday life there and find, you know, some strange stories or whatever. But then gradually, as the Marcos regime sort of began to show signs of crumbling and this election was called, I thought, well, I have to go there then for the election, although I didn't want to, because I didn't want to be there when there would be lots of other journalists there.
You were in the Philippines on the day that Cory Aquino was inaugurated, and simultaneously Ferdinand Marcos was sworn in.
Yeah.
You spent some time at each of those ceremonies, and I think, you know, you have written as a theater critic, and I think in a way you brought a theater critic's eye to your writing. I'd like to read a paragraph from your description of the ceremony in which Ferdinand Marcos was sworn in. And you write, Imelda's dress had a slit up the back, and somewhat inelegantly from our point of view, she reached into this slit for a handkerchief. She dabbed her eyes. She blew her nose rather too loudly. She looked again at the crowd with a look that said, My people, oh my people, you are the ones who have always supported us. You are the ones who have always understood. Marcos was gently helped from the balcony, but Imelda gave a version of not being able to bear the thought of leaving the crowd. She came back to the microphone and said words to the effect that at least there will be still some spirit among the Filipino people, and she would never forget them. It really is almost like, you know, theater.
Well, she's very theatrical. You know, people always compared her to Evita. She didn't like this. She said, well, at least I wasn't a prostitute, she said. But she was very like that kind of Evita-style legendary figure.
But I'm interested in the connection in your writing between theater criticism and political journalism. I think somehow the two must have informed each other.
Well, in theater criticism, the basic training is one of memory. You have to sit through a play, watching it, and remembering what a moment was like, and then describing it. It's a very good training.
You got into the palace at the Philippines shortly after the Marcoses fled.
Yeah.
And you have a monogrammed towel to show for it, a monogrammed Imelda Marcos towel. What did you do with the towel?
Oh, it's at home. Yeah, I used it, yeah. I mean, it's a useful little item.
It was, I'm sure, a very thrilling experience to be in the palace right after the Marcos government fell. Was it a frightening experience as well, given the crowds that were...
Well, actually, it had been frightening before because there was a real street battle, not between government forces and the crowd, but between two elements in the crowd. One element was the remains of the Marcos rent-a crowd people, and some of them went on being pro-Marcos, you know, for months and months after he'd gone, and some of them, I think, still expect him to come back. It was a really vicious street fight. But when that had died down, and when the crowd actually got into the palace, and the pro-Marcos people just dispersed, then it was so funny. I can't tell you how funny it was.
What was funny?
It was just people could not believe. You know, these were street urchins nobody had ever been into the palace before. I mean, as journalists, we had been. That's why I knew which way to go. But other people, a lot of people went into the wrong parts thinking, oh, this is the palace. But the ones who got actually to the state rooms could not believe their eyes and could not believe that they were sitting in the chair, you know, all taking it in turns to sit in the chair where Marcos had been sitting in only the day before, you know. And they were so gleeful. And then... by chance, finding the Marcos apartments just before, in the end, you know, the military took over, and I mean, the pro-Cory forces took over to stop the whole thing being torn to pieces, which I'm sure it would have otherwise been. But just for that moment, it was a tremendous fiesta, and it also it had a I think that one of the reasons that the February Revolution there was so breathtaking was that it had something of a religious element to it as well. It was the impetus it got came from the religious traditions of that country. That's why it became, I think, so powerful and unstoppable after a while.
You've seen history in the making several times. What keeps you going? What keeps you going from hotspot to hotspot? Because I know you express your fear in your pieces when you feel it, and you've felt fear many times. What keeps you going?
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't go from hotspot to hotspot. I do, like, 2.5 years or 3 years in one job, and then I think of something completely contrasting. So I've been in Korea and the Philippines recently, but in between times I was, doing the theatre or doing book reviewing and living a very sedate sort of life. And the other thing is that I don't, this may sound paradoxical, but I don't really court danger. I don't like danger. I don't like doing stupid things. I get annoyed with myself if I get into a dangerous position. I want to get near enough to be able to see what is happening, to be able to experience at first hand what is happening. But there's a difference between that and getting in the middle of a fight, as it were, which I don't like to do, and which indeed I don't do. I've never fought anybody in my life, he said, lying.
In one of your early pieces, you developed a rule that you called crepuscular journalism, and you said that you should never believe anything you're told before dusk.
Yeah.
Explain why you came up with that rule, and if now, many years later, if you still would like to operate that way.
Oh, yeah. It's if you're trying to talk to, say, soldiers or officers in a war, if you go along in the early morning before the battle has begun, or, you know... mid-morning, and you just try to interview them, then they'll give you one version of events. But actually, they're going to give you a version that is strictly for journalists. Whereas if you meet them after dusk and spend, you know, a good amount of time with them, and gradually night draws on and so on, then the nearer it is to midnight or even the early hours of the morning, the more truthful a picture you're going to get of what they really think. That's when you'll learn. So that was why it's called crepuscular. It's the evening school of journalism. You know, the wisdom begins with the dusk.
And you still try to operate that way when you
well,
can.
Well, the equivalent of that, which means that you try to work with people. In an informal way, you try to spend a good amount of time with anyone that you're trying to get to know, and you see them, you know, when they're relaxed and not on their guard, and you're looking for those relaxed moments rather than when they're giving you a script that they've given to other journalists, as it were.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed.
James Fenton's reports from the Pacific Rim have been collected in the book All the Wrong Places, which is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. He also has a collection of poems titled Children in Exile. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On the next show, I'll speak with the co-star of Kate and Ally, Jane Curtin. Curtin was also an original member of Saturday Night Live's Not Ready for Primetime Players. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the 1960s, reporter Marlene Sanders found herself explaining the women's movement not just to the public, but to her fellow workers as well. Coming up, Marlene Sanders talks about her career as one of the first women in television news. Walt Disney's movies are remembered not only for their stories, but also for their songs, tunes like Hi-Ho and When You Wish Upon a Star. Now there's a new album of songs from Disney films reworked by rock stars such as Buster Poindexter, Tom Waits, and Suzanne Vega. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Lair of the White Worm. It's the new movie from Ken Russell, who also directed Altered States and The Devils. It's based on a novel by Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Willman. The Soviet Union today formally admitted that its 1989 budget contains $57.6 billion in red ink. The report on the deficit came during an unusually revealing presentation to the Supreme Soviet, or their legislature. Kremlin officials unveiled their first budget designed to help the Soviet consumer, declaring that state-run farms and companies that don't make a profit will be shut down. The head of the Soviet State Planning Committee also promised dramatic improvements as the government shifts from its traditional emphasis on heavy industry to the apparently more politically sensitive area of boosting Soviet living standards. U.S. National Security Advisor Colin Powell today praised Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev for pushing economic reforms, but questioned how much could be done in a one-party communist state. Powell said that as Moscow pursues internal economic reforms, the country has been involved in fewer foreign policy adventures. Powell warned, though, that ethnic unrest could undo whatever progress is being made. President Reagan today said the new American Embassy office building in Moscow must be torn down and rebuilt from the ground up because the structure is riddled with Soviet listening devices. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
Construction on the U.S. Chancery building was halted in 1985 when American inspectors discovered the first Soviet listening devices. Since then, intelligence analysts have determined the bugging is so pervasive that to rip out the devices would destroy the integrity of the structure. There are no firm estimates on how long and how much it will take to rebuild, but one official involved with the project estimates 5 years and $300 million. To stop the Soviets from bugging the building again, construction material will be brought from the U.S. and guarded continuously. Because of the high costs involved, President Reagan has decided to consult with Congress first. But with Congress now in recess, that leaves the final decisions to a new Congress and a new administration. Until the chancery is completed, the Soviets will be barred from occupying their new office building in Washington. I'm Ann Garrels reporting.
George Bush received the endorsement of a small maritime union today in Tacoma, Washington. Bush promised that if elected, he would begin a much-needed revival of America's shipping industry. Bush ignored scuffles between police and a handful of protesters that broke out during the Tacoma rally. Later, he headed for campaign stops in California. Michael Dukakis rallied supporters in the crucial state of Illinois today. At an appearance in the Chicago suburb of Evergreen Park, Dukakis took aim at Bush's proposal to cut capital gains taxes from 33% to 15%. NPR's Linda Wertheimer has more.
Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis ridiculed Vice President George Bush's proposal to cut the capital gains tax today. Noting that the vice president has said his proposal would create jobs, Dukakis called it classic Republican trickle-down economics.
It's Halloween come early. A treat for the wealthiest 1% and a trick for the rest of us. That's really what's going on.
A jobs program, Dukakis asked the crowd in Evergreen Park, Illinois, and suggested that the wealthiest taxpayers who will receive the bulk of the tax cut might hire a lifeguard for their swimming pool. I'm Linda Wertheimer in Chicago.
Directors of the U.S.-backed Nicaraguan Contras today called on foreign governments and relief agencies to withhold hurricane relief aid to the Nicaraguan government. The Contra leaders suggested instead that assistance be funneled through church organizations. Hurricane Joan last week blasted Central America, killing more than 50 people in Nicaragua and leaving up to 300,000 homeless. A military spokesman in El Salvador today reported that three people were killed last night in a bus shootout between government troops and leftist guerrillas. The guerrillas reportedly surrounded the bus and opened fire on security troops on board. On Wall Street today, stock prices closed lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 24 points to close at 2140.83. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Many of our childhood fantasies were inspired by the films of Walt Disney. Songs from some of those films have been given a new twist on an album called Stay Awake. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Whistle while you work, whistle while you work, cheerfully together we can tidy up the place, hum a merry tune.
The music that appeared in the Walt Disney movies of the 40s, 50s, and 60s occupies a unique place in American popular music. Songs like Hi Ho from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, When You Wish Upon a Star from Pinocchio. They're not exactly standards, or if they are, they're novelty tune standards, inseparable from the movies in which they appeared. But Stay Awake, the new collection of Disney songs overseen by producer Hal Wilner, does rip those compositions from their original contexts and puts them into unexpected mouths. Here, for example, is Hi Ho, as sung, to use a very loose definition of that word, by Tom Waits. I played that one to startle you. It's probably the most radical reinterpretation of a Disney song ever. Before you heard it, the title of that tune probably summoned up the colorful image of the seven cartoon dwarfs hoisting pickaxes over their backs and bumbling off to work in a coal mine. Tom Waits, however, sings that song as if he was trapped at the bottom of that coal mine, with the black dust collecting in his lungs. By contrast, there's a version of a song from Dumbo, Baby Mine, that stays a bit closer to its original arrangement. It's sung by Bonnie Raitt, who is backed by the band called Was Not Was.
From your head to your toes, you're not much, goodness knows, but you're so precious to me, cute as can be,
baby of mine.
I think it's a measure of Bonnie Raitt's gorgeous vocal that that song, which in the movie is a lullaby sung to Dumbo by his mother, becomes a much more ravishing piece of music, a kind of sensuous blues. Producer Hal Wilner is doing something more here than creating a novelty record with intellectual pretensions. On his earlier projects, Wilner invited odd assortments of musicians to record versions of music written by composers as various as Thelonious Monk, Kurt Weill, and Nino Rota. The quality of these records is, of course, wildly uneven, but what they all share is Wilner's notion of manipulating your memory, of disrupting your familiarity with music you thought you knew. No matter what you think of Wilner's premise, he's gotten some striking results. For example, there will be few moments in 1988 pop music, I think, more beautiful than Aaron Neville's version of all things, the Mickey Mouse Club theme.
Through the years, we'll all be friends, wherever we may be. Ooh. M.I.C. Oh, we're gonna see you real soon. Oh, we're gonna see you real soon. K.E.Y. Why? Because we love you. Oh, because we love you. Oh, because we love you. Yeah. Oh, you.
There's a fair amount of stuff on Stay Awake that puts me to sleep. Buster Poindexter sings Castle in Spain from Babes in Toyland as if he's too busy winking at the campiness of it all to actually emote. Suzanne Vega's version of Stay Awake from the movie Mary Poppins is a solemn a cappella drag. There are also jazzy versions of three Disney songs by guitarist Bill Frisell and keyboardist Wayne Horvitz. As much as I admire them in other circumstances, their fractured interpretations are curiously predictable here, once you tune into their hip, abstract wavelength. Then, too, some of the unevenness of this album isn't the fault of the musicians. You have to remember that most of these songs are semi-standards by accident, hackwork, verses, and choruses composed to fill up time in a movie. But of course, sometimes the very mediocrity of a piece of music can be liberating, even inspiring to an interpreter. This is very true of Harry Nilsson's witty yet passionate reading of Zippity Doodah from Song of the South.
Yeah, plenty of sunshine. Heading my way. Zippity.
Stay Awake is not a record to buy for your five-year-old to introduce the child to the joys of Walt Disney movie music. It's a baby boom curiosity, a good example of the way postmodern pop can accommodate absolutely anything.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Will come to you if your heart.
That's Ringo singing, and this is Fresh Air. Marlene Sanders never became one of network TV's star reporters, but she was one of its pioneer woman journalists. Her first job was in 1955 as a production assistant for a local news show in New York, hosted by Mike Wallace. She went on to become one of network TV's first woman reporters and the first woman vice president in a news division. In her last network job, she anchored the CBS news breaks. She now anchors her own show on public TV in New York. Marlene Sanders is the co-author of Waiting for Prime Time. It's based on her experiences and those of other women at the networks. In 1964, Sanders made broadcast history when she was the first woman to anchor a network evening newscast. I asked her how she was chosen to fill in when Ron Cochran suddenly lost his voice.
Well, I was the one that did the news in the afternoon. He was the one that did it at night. And the man who was the vice president of news, Jesse Zausmer, who was a great supporter of mine, he thought I was good and all that. And I don't know how they decided. They called and said, can you substitute for Cochran tonight? He lost his voice. And I had about 3 hours to, yeah, sir. Yes, I said, certainly. And I ran home and figured out what I should wear. And I came back and I just did it.
What kind of notice did it get, either in the press or from viewers? Was there a lot of attention paid to the fact that this was a woman anchoring an evening newscast?
Well, the New York Times wrote it up as a first. Jack Gould, who was a television critic, I can remember that review almost verbatim. He called me a courageous young woman with a Vassar smile, who had a no-nonsense manner, which is always the way I've done the news. And there was that. There was no bad response. But on the other hand, nothing else happened. I went back to the afternoon and to the stories I usually did. And it wasn't, nobody said, great, a breakthrough for women. It's a good idea. Let's do it. So nothing happened.
In 1970, you did a documentary called Women's Liberation on the women's movement. This was for ABC. And you say in your book that you didn't like the way the men reporters were covering the women's movement. What did you think was wrong with their coverage?
Well, they didn't understand it. I mean, they literally didn't understand it. They thought it had something to do with chivalry, that and that everybody hated, the women involved were hated men. That it had to do with the, do you open the door for someone, do you light the cigarette, all this nonsense. And they really were putting it down. And I knew, of course, it was about equal opportunity, jobs, all of that kind of thing. So I went to the head of the documentary unit and I said, listen, I'd really like to do a half hour on what this is all about. And he was a very intelligent, good person. He said, go do it, which I did. And then I did a number of them afterwards.
But you were surprised that you encountered a degree of distrust among the feminists who you were covering.
Well, because there were a lot of factions in the feminist movement, and for one thing, they suspected me because I worked for the media that was the enemy in many respects, and how could I really understand if I worked for these people? And so I had a lot of hassles, not only with the management in getting to do these things, but actually some of the women involved. So that made it, interesting and a challenge.
Feminism had its effect within the networks as well. There was a lot of organizing going on in the 70s inside the networks for equal pay for women and for other women's rights. You co-founded a group called the Women's Action Committee at ABC. And I guess I'm thinking about how hard it must be in a very, very competitive field like broadcasting to have a sense of solidarity with people who you're working with when you're also competing for the limited number of good jobs.
Well, the interesting thing about that was that at that time there were almost no women in news. I was one of the few. The rest were from public relations. They were at the corporate end. We didn't even know each other. I was not competitive with any of these people. We were all women from very different kinds of jobs who had looked at the women of the magazines, Time, Life, Newsweek, Fortune, all AP. There were all sorts of activities going on, and somehow we all found each other, got going, and got it started. Now, 10 years later at ABC, there now exists a group of all newswomen, and that means producers, writers, correspondents. They could have a whole group of newswomen. Well, I couldn't have had a group of newswomen. That would have been a group of two, maybe. So we were not competitive. We were wonderfully supportive of each other, and it was a terrific feeling at that time.
What do you think were the greatest gains that you got from organizing?
Well, first of all, making the managements aware of their bad record and the fact that women were kept out of certain jobs. What I think is the permanent accomplishment is that the doors are open from the very bottom almost to the top. In other words, women can get into the pipeline. They can be not only desk assistants, but tape editors and members of camera crews and reporters and producers and a few in management. That still remains to be solved, that particular area. But all the networks now have a lot of women in a great variety of jobs, and that was not happening not too many years ago.
For a while, you anchored the CBS Newsbreak, which is a short, minute-long newscast?
About that.
In prime time, in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my reaction the first time I saw you doing a newsbreak. I was like, gee, a real woman. I mean, I was used to seeing women anchoring, but mostly on the local level, and frequently the women were chosen, it seems, as much for their looks as for journalistic skills. And you just struck me as a real person, a real skilled person, as opposed to someone who was hired for being young and attractive. And it was very exciting for me.
Well, I've heard that from other people, and it really makes me feel good, too, because it's a peculiar skill to reduce the news of the world to, 10-second stories.
Right.
And also, it was live, and it was in front of 30, 40 million people. And I felt that, it had some symbolic benefit. So I'm happy to hear that your reaction was what I would have hoped.
Well, I always wonder if reactions like that count for anything in terms of network decision-making.
I don't know. Who knows? We just don't know. And as far as the women who are at the networks today, they are reasonably optimistic about their longevity in the business. A number of the most prominent women on air now are in their mid-40s, and they think that the age factor isn't going to work against them. They don't know for sure yet, but they are very positive about it.
Do you know why you lost the Newsbreak spot?
Well, actually, what happened was I was doing Sunday Morning and a lot of other things when they had the cutbacks of a year and a half ago, and they asked me to move to radio full-time, basically doing hourly newscasts, which I had also been doing. No, I don't know. I don't know whether they just... I think what this is all about is that they wanted to feature in major spots their designated stars. Why bother with somebody like me, who's a good reporter and all that, but not anybody that was going to be on the Rather News, not anybody who was on their A team rather than the B team. So I think that was probably part of the decision. Ironically, shortly afterwards, they canceled news breaks altogether. They don't do them anymore.
I want to read the way that you end your new book, and I'll preface this by saying that you left the CBS network when you agreed mutually to terminate your contract. You end your new book by saying, "To all who choose to meet the challenge, one final word, do not mistake a job for home and family or a trusted friend. It cannot be counted on. It can turn you out in an instant. However you decide to live your life, it is important to have personal involvements separate from your profession that will sustain you when, for whatever reason, your work comes to an end." Is that advice you took yourself when you were at the network?
That's advice I took all of my professional life. I was very fortunate. I had a long marriage. My husband died nearly 5 years ago, but I also raised a son who is a very accomplished young lawyer working on the Iran-Contra investigation. I had a personal life. I had a family. And believe me, I had a lot of ups and downs in my career, and that was very important. I think it is vital. Now, not everybody is going to get married in this world, but there are other ways you can have relationships and have other interests. It's just the kind of business that consumes you. People become workaholics. It's a very demanding and interesting life. But I saw people who were fired a year and a half ago who had spent their entire careers at CBS. They were single women. It was their home. It was their family. And they were devastated. And what did they have at that point? They had nothing. And I think it's just terribly, terribly sad.
Okay. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Marlene Sanders is the co-author of Waiting for Prime Time, The Women of Television News, published by the University of Illinois Press. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up later from National Public Radio. The hosts are busy putting the show together, but I've got some information to fill you in on what they're covering. We'll hear about why the stock market went down today. Barbara Mantell reports on a warning that the Federal Reserve Bank issued about takeovers. Some takeover stocks actually took the Dow Jones Industrials down. On the campaign trail, we'll hear about Lenora Falani, a third-party candidate who's the first black woman presidential candidate to be on the ballot in all 50 states and receive federal matching funds. Also, a report on the South African elections and letters from listeners. These stories and more today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Just in time for Halloween, a new contemporary tongue-in-cheek gothic horror film directed by Ken Russell. Lair of the White Worm is based on a novel by the author of Dracula. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
There's a place for filmmakers like Ken Russell. If not at a theater near you, then surely in a well-appointed padded cell. Russell used to be taken rather seriously in the days when he was making movies like Women in Love and The Devils from novels by D.H. Lawrence and Aldous Huxley. But no matter how hard he worked to maintain a distinguished air, Russell couldn't hide his deeply ingrained lunacy. He was like some reclusive British earl of the most impeccable lineage, who threw open his splendid castle to visitors, and then proceeded to howl and dance and expose himself till the wee hours. Russell favored nudity and naughty sex, homosexual revelations, cruelty of every stripe, and the noisier the better, vertiginous camera movement, and luscious candy apple colors and textures. Every now and then, his trash-the-world sensibility seemed perfectly appropriate. When he filmed the rock opera Tommy, for instance, and when he romped all over Paddy Chayefsky's self-important script for Altered States. But for the most part, Russell was rarely appreciated for what he is, one of the most endearingly silly men in the movie business. His new film, The Lair of the White Worm, shows off his brand of silliness at its most seductive. Since it's Ken Russell, the source has to be some musty old volume of forgotten lore, and in this case, it's an exceedingly minor Bram Stoker novel, which Russell has hysterically updated to the 80s. The premise is this. In northern England, local legend buzzes about a terrible white dragon or worm, the source and subject of various ancient religious rites. The worm seems to be haunting the district still, despite the claims of the local lord, young Dampton, that his ancestor killed the dragon centuries before. Now Lady Sylvia Marsh has been hanging around, talking about snakes and generally acting suspicious. And young Lord Dampton, played by Hugh Grant, takes it upon himself to visit her. Unfortunately, he's just interrupted a game of snakes and ladders she's been playing with a wandering Boy Scout, who now lies dead in her luxurious bathtub.
I loathe snakes. I have a morbid fear of them. The legend of the Dampton worm terrifies me, and I could never have come to your party in a million years.
Well, then why do you torture yourself playing snakes and ladders?
I really don't know. It's a compulsion. As a child, I was in a coma for 10 days as the result of a snake bite. And ever since, I've had a revulsion for them. And also a terrible fascination. I'm afraid I'm a bit of a schizophrenic.
That scene, with its amazingly cheesy music, is typical. But it can't quite convey the full aroma of Russell's puns, his cheap and lusciously gaudy horror effects, his ghastly screenwriting, and best of all, his way with actors. It's funny enough watching the very good young English actress Sammy Davis writhe uncomfortably beneath her North Country accent, and it's downright hilarious watching Catherine Oxenberg, as her virginal older sister, shriek and stagger under the White Worm's hypnotic influence. But Oxenberg is merely bad. Amanda Donahoe, as Lady Sylvia, the snake priestess, is something more. Breathing her lines through the snootiest accent this side of Belgravia, and flicking her tongue as she goes to kiss her latest victim, Donahoe gives the kind of unself-consciously nutty performance that late-night TV was made for. When Lord Dampton broadcasts snake charmer music and Donahoe slithers out of her basket and starts hoochie-cooching toward the castle, well, in a moment like that, all Ken Russell's sins are forgiven. Elvira, look to thy laurels.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Cyndi Lauper's hit All Through the Night and the Bangles hit If She Knew What She Wants were both written by Jules Shear. But Jules Shear's own versions of his songs have never had such commercial success. Next time, Shear talks with us about his songwriting, his singing, and his new band, Reckless Sleepers. Also, critic at large Laurie Stone looks at how women are portrayed in three new sitcoms, Roseanne, Baby Boom, and Murphy Brown. And New Orleans pianist Harry Connick Jr. returns in our weekly performance spot, so I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Fred Landerl, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.